I remembered to bring it today. Here's an interesting thing, because many people have the idea that language and writing and things, it's like a modern thing, and it only came about, you know, a few hundred years ago or so, say. We know that that's not the case, because we have the Word, we have other writings. But here's an interesting thing about language. So if humans have evolved from less intelligent creatures, one would expect the earliest written languages to be the least complex. The exact opposite is true. And think of this. It's actually the oldest written languages that are the most complex. Ancient Chinese and Greek were far more complicated than modern Chinese and Greek. One of the most difficult of all written languages is Sanskrit, which goes back to 1500 BC. Long time. In the Sanskrit language, each verb, each verb had up to 500 variations. Can you imagine that? Had up to 500 variations. Compare this with English, in which most verbs have only what? Five forms. Do, does, did, done, doing. Ancient Chinese, which originated before 2000 BC, the ancient Chinese language, had 6,000 characters or letters. How many characters or letters does modern English have? 26. 26. How many letters are in the Hebrew language? 22. In Greek, comparable. At least Koine Greek, anyway. As it says, there's no group of humans anywhere in the world that does not have a fully developed, highly complex, descriptive language. Even people groups using, quote-unquote, Stone Age tool for survival had highly developed languages. When God created man, he did not create man with grunts. Contrary to what is popularly taught, we did not come from apes. And man was not created with grunts. Man was created with a language. Wouldn't it be grunts that God would tell Adam that he wanted him to name the animals as they went by? Who named those? Adam did. So God is the one who gave language. And as I said, he didn't give grunts like they depict on telly and in different programs. These facts sharply contradict the theory that language has evolved from grunts to grammar, from simple to complex, from primitive to civilized. It didn't. Even some of our Native American groups have highly developed language. Not written down as such, but what? Mm-hmm. Exactly. But that's a language in itself. I mean, even you look at modern Chinese and from the Asian languages, Japanese and so forth, and their characters. I mean, you're talking wide variety. But that didn't just come up, evolve, like it said, from grunts and then to grammar. God created man with fully known, with a fully developed language. Now, here's the other thing I mentioned last week, but this goes a little more in detail. This is for Tina. The turkey vulture has incredibly far-sighted vision, capable of seeing dead or dying objects several miles beyond what the human eye can detect. Yet it is designed with dull, weak talons and a thin beak, which forces it to eke out an existence eating rotting flesh or decaying vegetables. Since the vulture eats the remains of animals that have died of disease, it has a digestive tract designed to destroy deadly bacteria, including anthrax. The turkey vulture also has the ability, and get this, the turkey vulture also has the ability to sanitize itself and its surroundings using a special disinfectant which is found in its own dung. Okay, in his own excrement, as we say, poop. So it sanitizes itself with that. The same chemicals which kill the deadly bacteria in its stomach also continue to kill the germs outside its body. And because the vulture's head is usually covered in blood, pieces of rotten flesh and bacteria, it's especially vulnerable to disease. Therefore, the turkey vulture, this particular bird, was created without feathers. Now get this, was created without feathers from the neck up. As the turkey vulture stands in the sun, the ultraviolet radiation kills any remaining bacteria. And by removing the carcasses of decaying animals, the turkey vulture serves an important purpose of limiting the spread of disease and preventing potential epidemics among both man and beast. Now, one wonders how the turkey vulture could have evolved all of those specialized characteristics and survived. The creation solution is that they were created that way. God designed him that way. If that wasn't the case, how would the poor thing survive over time, right? That's what I think. Anyway. So there you have a little knowledge about the turkey vulture as such. Interesting to say the least. So in our remaining time, as we turn to the Word, returning to Lamentations chapter 4, we're almost finished with our trek through Lamentations here, and the next series, we want to prepare for that, we'll begin to go through the Gospel of Mark. I think Mark's a good gospel to preach and teach from, especially in the things that we're going through. And I'll give a little introduction of that in a couple of weeks. Now, Lamentations 4, this next chapter in the Hebrew, is an acrostic as well. You think of Jeremiah, he's a prophet, but Jeremiah's also a poet. That God blessed him with the ability to craft his word like he has. And you think of these laments, lamentations, as poetry as well in the way that Jeremiah has designed them. And so in this chapter, in chapter 4, it's an acrostic as well. Just like the first two chapters, except in the first two chapters, had three lines, but in chapter 4, each verse has two lines. And each one of those, as I said, begins with a letter of the Hebrew alphabet as we go down. And as you see, there's 22 verses in Lamentations 4. And how many letters are there in the Hebrew alphabet? 22. So for each verse, he begins with Aleph, and then Beit, and then Gimel, and so forth. So, of course, the Jewish people and God's people would understand that and the reason why. So he does this for a purpose and for a reason why he puts it into an acrostic like he does. But instead, and like I said, in chapter 4, it has two lines instead of three. In this chapter, in this lament, Jeremiah gives a description and an explanation of the tragic consequences of what God's people did. Of the tragic consequences of the people's transgressions against Yahweh. And again, there's a lesson in this for us today as well. And we turn first to the description the poet and prophet Jeremiah relates. In the first 10 verses, he gives the description of the consequences of God's judgment upon his people. Of the consequences of their sinning against him and disobeying him. Now notice what Jeremiah does here. The people who he focuses on. And you think about this as we read this and we go through it. You think about how that relates to today and what is going on. It's important, vitally important. And I'm going to get to that in just a little minute. What leaders, who leaders are, and what leaders do. Because the direction a leader can take a nation, a people, will have an effect. And it did here. And we'll get to that in just a bit. But the first place that Jeremiah now puts his focus on, he's coming back to the people. Now notice what he says in verses 1 and 2. How dark, alas, how dark the gold has become. The pure gold has changed. The sacred stones are poured out. At the corner of every street, those sacred stones are poured out. That's the corner of every street. Verse 2. The precious sons of Zion, Jerusalem is Zion. Yahweh, God's city, weighed against fine gold, how they are regarded as earthen jars, the work of a potter's hands. And you look at those first two verses, and people are one to take it literally. What in the world? Jeremiah is saying that gold has become dark and there's gold on every street corner? Wow! Isn't that something? Let's get some of that gold. Jeremiah's not speaking literally. He's using a metaphor. He's using a metaphor here. He's not speaking of actual jewels. Why would he be speaking about actual jewels? Why would there be actual gold on every corner of every street? For heaven's sakes, the Babylonians would leave precious jewels around? That's one of the first things they took. Remember who Hezekiah showed everything in Jerusalem? Everything in Judah too. All the gold in the temple. All those fine gold utensils and everything. Who did Hezekiah show that to? Why, the nobles and leaders of the Babylonians, of Babylon. And I think was Isaiah. What Isaiah said to Hezekiah? Hezekiah, who are these people? And Hezekiah tells him, what did they see? Hezekiah said, they saw everything. Hezekiah didn't lie to Isaiah, did he? He said, well, you know, what's the big deal? They saw everything. And what did Isaiah tell Hezekiah? Everything that they saw, they will get. And Hezekiah says, well, you know, as long as they don't get it while I'm here. Because Isaiah told them when it would happen, when it would come about. Remember what Hezekiah said? Peace. It's all right. I'll have peace until I'm dead, until I'm gone. And then we know how that worked out. So these were not valuable, actual gold and valuable jewels laying in the street. These are metaphors that he is using. Do you know what it refers to? It refers to the most valuable assets in the nation. What was the most valuable asset in the nation? Or we could say more so, who was the most valuable asset in the nation? Eric? What's that? God? Well, that's not false. He is the most valuable asset. But who is the most valuable asset that was laying on every corner of the street? People Eric's age. The young people. The young people were the most valuable asset to the nation. This is what Jeremiah is referring to. This is who he means. And what he is saying is that young people, Carson and Eric's age, and those who cannot fight, but yet they are what we could say young people, youth of the day, are lying dead at every street corner. And Jeremiah says they are like those precious jewels. That's the gold he's referring to. Just as then, just as now, how valuable gold was taken. But Jeremiah is here using this as an asset. And yes, Eric's not false in that. It is correct. The most valuable asset of all for God's people was him. But God, as far as his people were concerned, considered the most valuable assets to be the youth, to be the young people. The young people are dead and lie scattered like so much broken pottery. That's what Jeremiah is referring to. Because he focuses then. He says, how they are regarded as earthen jars, the work of a potter's hands. They're broken. Think about that today. At our young people. And what they are striving to do to our youth. This critical race theory and all these other kinds of things that they're pushing and that. What would that do ultimately to our youth, to our young people? It will not only divide them and really make them hate one another, it will ineffectively destroy them. That's the ultimate outcome. And you see what Jeremiah is saying, this is what the young people in Jerusalem are right now. They're not alive, they're dead. And this thing that they're pushing nowadays with the vaccine for young people as young as 5, Peter McCullough, epidemiologist from out of Texas, and I believe he's correct in that. People don't listen to him, of course. They want to listen to somebody else. Because you have to ask yourself, as someone has said, where's the money? Follow the money. But as Peter McCullough said, he believes this, that if they push the vaccine on these young people who do not need it, that there will be more young people die from that than from this virus. He could be very well correct in that. So again, what is Jeremiah trying to do here? He's focusing on the young people. He focuses on the famine that resulted. And now notice what he says in verses 3 through 5. He's talked about the youth, those Eric's age and a little older than that. And that they're dead, lying dead on every corner of the street. Now look what he says. He wants his people to really get it. He doesn't mince words here. He says, even jackals offer the breast. They nurse their young. The daughter of my people has become cruel. Like ostriches in the wilderness. The tongue of the infant cleaves. See, now Jeremiah is talking about younger ones, the children and the infants. The roof of its mouth, the tongue of the infant cleaves to the roof of its mouth because of thirst. The little ones ask for bread. No one breaks it for them. I mean, they're not given bread. Those who ate delicacies are desolate in the streets. Those reared in purple, they embrace ash pits. Now let's unwrap this. What Jeremiah is telling, he's saying the little ones are dying of starvation. The infants who would suckle at their mother's breast, still at that young age, not there. Nothing to eat. The famine that has resulted. These are consequences real consequences of things that God's people has done. And the result of that, the little ones have nothing to eat and no milk to drink. Just think about what he is saying here. What he is saying here is that God's children, the children of God's people in Judah and Jerusalem, were left to fend for themselves. To get food, milk, what have you. And he is saying there was no one to take care of them. Unlike the cubs of the jackals, those wild canine-like dogs, jackals, that prowled around, especially after sieges and battles in the ancient world. The jackals would take care of their pups, no matter what. Their mothers took care of them. However, the prophet says that the mothers of Jerusalem act more like the ostrich. The mother ostrich was noted for its cruelty and neglect of not just their young, but the neglect of their eggs. They would lay an egg buried or what have you, like an ostrich do, and then leave it. And that's what Jeremiah is saying the mothers of Jerusalem are doing to their children. They're neglecting them. And he says, when he goes on and he talks about in verse 5 there, he is saying even the children of royalty are treated no different. And when it says they embrace the ash pits, literally in the Hebrew, that's what he is saying. What he is saying is that the children, the young people of Jerusalem, because of what has happened, and their mothers do not care about them, have neglected them. Many of their fathers are probably dead. But no one is taking care of them. What are they doing? Embracing the ash pits means that they're going wherever they can go and going through the garbage and what has happened on the battlefield to find something to eat so that they can survive. Can we apply that to today? I believe we can in many ways. So now Jeremiah makes a comparison. Notice what he says. For the iniquity, the sins, the transgressions of the daughter of my people is greater. Now, look at what he says here. It's greater than the sin of Sodom, which was overthrown as in a moment, and no hands were turned toward her. Greater than the sin of Sodom. We know why God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, do we not? Because of their wickedness, their evilness. And much of it had to do with how they expressed themselves sexually. They were doing what Paul laid out in Romans chapter 1. What a contrast that is with God's city, Zion, Jerusalem, with Sodom. And what Jeremiah is saying is Sodom's destruction was like that. Sodom and Gomorrah ended like that. Hail and fire and brimstone come down. And what Jeremiah says, though, Jerusalem and Judah, their suffering, their destruction was prolonged. It lasted for many months. in the end, approximately about 18 months. Can you imagine that? A year and a half. It wasn't just the punishment that was greater, though. Jeremiah says it wasn't the punishment that was greater. It was the transgressions. That's what he said. For the iniquity of the daughter of my people, the sins that they had committed to Yahweh was greater than what even Sodom and Gomorrah did. That's what Jeremiah is saying. Now notice what he goes on to say. Her consecrated ones were purer than snow. They were whiter than milk. They were more ruddy in body than corals. Their polishing was like lapis lazuli, a fine jewel. Their appearance is blacker than soot. They are not recognized in the streets. Their skin is shriveled on their bones. It is withered. It has become like wood. Better are those slain with the sword than those slain with hunger. For they pine away, being stricken for lack of the fruits of the field. The hands of compassionate women boiled their own children. They became food for them because of the destruction of the daughter of my people. What he says in those verses before is that even the royalty, the princes of Judah, are no longer recognizable. They are nothing but skin and bones. Darkness does not refer to black. It does not refer to a what he says here does not refer to a specific color. It refers to darkness. And the Hebrew literally reads what Jeremiah says here. It is better for those who were pierced by the sword than for those who were pierced by the famine. Because you're pierced by the sword, you die by the sword, you die pretty fast, don't you? But by famine, it's a slow death. The saddest of all, though, what Jeremiah relates here, brothers and sisters, is the mothers of Judah. For some of the mothers of Judah had no maternal affection anymore. Who were they thinking of? Me, myself, and I. How I can survive. How I can survive this. So how did they survive this? They were reduced to cannibalism. They boiled. This is literally. They ate their children. That's what Jeremiah says. Did not God warn them about this? Oh, yes, he did many, many years ago. If you look at Deuteronomy chapter 28, verses 53 through 57, notice what God told them. It's part of the curses. Remember the blessings and the curses? Well, this is part of that. In Deuteronomy chapter 28, notice what God says here. If they do not follow Yahweh, what will happen? Then you shall eat the offspring of your own body, the flesh of your sons and of your daughters, whom the Lord your God has given you during the siege and the distress by which your enemy will oppress you. The man who is refined and very delicate among you shall be hostile toward his brother, and toward the wife he cherishes, and toward the rest of his children who remain, so that he will not give one of them any of the flesh of his children which he will eat. Since he has nothing left, during the siege and the distress by which your enemy will oppress you and all your town. The refined and delicate woman among you who would not venture to set the sole of her foot on the ground for delicateness and refinement shall be hostile toward the husband she cherishes and toward her son and daughter. And toward her afterbirth, which she issues from between her legs, and toward her children whom she bears. Now notice what God tells them there. I know it's gross. I know it's graphic. But God is trying to tell them this because it really would happen. And he wants them to think about it. And he's serious. This is what he says. For she will eat them seriously, secretly. She will eat them secretly. The afterbirth and her child, for lack of anything else during the siege and the distress by which your enemy will oppress you in your towns. And that actually happened. And this is what Jeremiah is talking about. You see how he could weep, how he could lament because of what God's people did? So last of all, we move then to verses 11 through 20 because what Jeremiah is going to do, he doesn't mince words. He's going to give an explanation for those consequences of their transgressions against Yahweh, for the consequences of the Babylonian destruction. Now notice what he says. For Jeremiah says, need you think there's not a cause? There is an ultimate cause after all. Notice what he says. The Lord has accomplished his wrath. He has poured out his fierce anger, and he has kindled a fire in Zion, Jerusalem, which has consumed its foundations. And it did. Now notice what he says. He mentioned Yahweh first. But now look at what he says. The kings of the earth did not believe, nor did any of the inhabitants of the world, that the adversary and the enemy could enter the gates of Jerusalem. You see, the leaders of the city, that included those false prophets and all the other leaders in Judah and Jerusalem. It included King Zedekiah. And it included other nations around them. You see, what they believed is they believed that Jerusalem could never fall. Jerusalem would never be destroyed. Where did that belief come from? I believe it arose from what is recorded in 2 Kings chapter 19, verse 35 following. This is what became known as the 701, 701 theology. And the Jews continued to believe in that. Judah and all the people of Jerusalem continued to believe in 701 theology. Because you see, it was in 701 BC, 701 BC, that a miracle happened. As we read in 2 Kings 19, verse 35 and following. What was that miraculous? Remember that Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, sent Rabshakeh to Hezekiah to tell him, Hezekiah, give up. I am going to take Jerusalem, your people, give up. Surrender to me. Remember that? And what Hezekiah does? Isaiah encourages Hezekiah. Hezekiah prays. And then what happens? He sees that Sennacherib defied God. Sennacherib said, "Thus you shall say to Hezekiah, king of Judah, do not let your God in whom you trust deceive you, saying, Jerusalem will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Behold, you have heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all the land, destroying them completely, so will you be spared?" See, he'd already taken Israel. "Did the gods of those nations which my fathers destroyed deliver them, even Gozan and Haran and Reseph, and the sons of Eden who were in Telassar? Where is the king of Hamath, the king of Arpad, the king of the city of Sephara, and of Hena and Iva? Where are they?" So Hezekiah prays. And Isaiah, Yahweh through Isaiah, gives him a sign. And we know what happened. In verse 33 following, notice what God told them. "By the way that he came, by the same he will return, and he shall not come to this city, declares the Lord. For I will defend this city to save it for my own sake and for my servant David's sake." Then it happened that night that the anger of the Lord went out and struck 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when men rose early in the morning, behold, all them were dead. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and returned home, and he lived at Nineveh. And it came about as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, that Adrammelech and Sharezer killed him with the sword. That was two of his sons. And they escaped into the land of Arat, and Esarhaddon, his son, became king in his place. That's where they got the idea that nothing would ever happen to Jerusalem or Judah, for God will defend it for his name. So they believed, you see, that they could continue to do whatever they wanted to do, because God wouldn't destroy Jerusalem. It's his. Little do they know, huh? But there's plenty of blame to go around. Notice what Jeremiah says. "Because of the sins of her prophets, the iniquities of her priests, who have shed in her midst the blood of the righteous." That's the shedding of innocent blood. That's them causing people to be killed because they prophesied falsely and transgressed against Yahweh. And ultimately, the blood of the righteous is referring to the fact that they gave their own children in sacrifice to idols. The sins of the spiritual leaders is what Jeremiah is talking about. The wicked priests and the prophets. Now notice how they're treated. "They wandered blind in the streets. They were defiled with blood so that no one could touch their garments. And they were told, 'Depart, unclean,' they cried of themselves. So they fled and they wandered among the nations. And people among the nations said, 'They shall not continue to dwell with us. They're not coming here.' The presence of the Lord has scattered them. He will not continue to regard them. They do not honor the priests. They did not favor the elders." And notice what he says here. They no longer listen to them. And what Jeremiah says, Yahweh has rejected you, because you did falsely. And then notice what he says. He doesn't end there. He says, Yet our eyes failed, for help was useless, and our watching we have watched for a nation that could not save. They hunted our steps so that we could not walk on our street. Our end drew near, our days were finished, for our end had come. Our pursuers were swifter than the eagles of the sky. They chased us on the mountains, they waited in ambush for us in the wilderness. The breath of our nostrils, the Lord's anointed, was captured in their pits, of whom we had said, under his shadow we shall live among the nations. God, what Jeremiah is saying, that because of the obstinance and disobedience of the people to Yahweh, you see, they believed erroneously that some other nation would come to their aid. We're going to get help. We'll get help from elsewhere. Maybe Egypt. Maybe this one. They believed in that obstinately. And they believed that they, with help, could overcome Babylon. They could eventually flee the city if need be. And then finally they believed King Zedekiah himself would save them. Did he save them? No. He fled along with his sons. And we know what happened to them. They were captured, taken to Riblah. The last thing Zedekiah saw was his sons being killed right in front of his eyes. And then his eyes were put out. Can you imagine that? Because of his disobedience and his obstinance, and his refusal to listen to God's prophets, to Jeremiah, the last thing he sees is his son slaughtered before him. Talking about consequences. So what about today? How can we relate that to today? We can. It can be related to today. We look at what people allow and what they think today, not just from the virus, but other things as well. From the killing of their own children. Do not tell me that a little one in the womb is not a baby. They might say, they're trying to say it's tissue. It's a fetus. Do they understand what in Latin what fetus means? Fetus means baby in Latin. And they want to say that that's okay. Did you know Oregon now has passed a thing where they are giving, I guess it's just state employees, what have you, that they are giving bereavement pay to women who have abortions. They are giving them bereavement leave and pay for abortion. Bereavement? Why would they be bereaved? Is it not because they know that what they have done and what they are doing is destroying a little one? Not that it's just my body and I can do with it what I want. That's odd that they can still say that and believe that, but yet when it comes to this vaccine thing, they want to force it on people. That's not how those things work, isn't it? In the year 2000, I'll end with this. I got this from Dearman in his commentary on Lamentations. In July of 2000, this was written by Thomas Lynch. It was entitled, A Man's Right to Choose. And you see where we have come in these 20-odd years. His first point has to do with the essence of adulthood in modern America, which is to exercise choice among options. he notes that he has three sons and a daughter. He says that his three sons and daughter can choose their sexual partners and how much to invest in their broader relationship that comes with that sexual activity. He says that choices and commitments are not easy, and he hopes, as do all parents, that his children will choose wisely. Now, he wrote this in July 2000 in the New York Times. It was an editorial. Including the taking of precautions to avoid unwanted pregnancies. But here's his point. This is what he wonders. That since his daughter can legally avail herself of the option to terminate a pregnancy, why cannot also his three sons legally avail themselves of the option to disallow responsibility for an unwanted child? He says, if the choice as to when one is ready, willing, and able to parent is a good thing, wouldn't it be good for my sons as well? And if that choice may be exercised by women after conception, then shouldn't men have the same option to proclaim legally and unilaterally the end of their interest in the tissue or fetus or baby or whatever it is that happens when there's sex between a man and a woman sometimes produces? See, his point is that once a child is born, the father is forced minimally into 18 years of fiscal responsibility. He thinks that it would be better if men, as well as women, can choose whether to be a parent or not. And that the state should not compel men any more than women to be parents. Well, who takes care of the children then? Of that? Why, the state does, of course. Of course, that's what they want all along. As Terry McAuliffe says, no parents, right, to understand or to know what their child is being educated. It's only the state. From the womb to the tomb is what the state wants. But what he's saying here, can we identify that with what Jeremiah is saying there? Metaphorically, I believe we can. As he said, as Dearman ends, in the 21st century, it is still the case that there is no evading of responsibility in God's way of things. So that it is false and misleading to view life as comprised primarily of morally neutral choices to be made by autonomous people. And that's what they are wanting today. We have no right to move in and out of social commitments, as he says, like stock options and building a portfolio. Today, just as it was in Jeremiah's day, the past, present, and future alike, still, whether man wants to believe in it or not, still comes under the refining, the judging, and need I say, the transforming ways of God, of the work of God. Wickedness. No matter what man may say, it is true then, and it still remains so. God will expose wickedness, and he will deal with it. Our thing is, What we have to come to believe and understand and continue to do so is that God has dealt with us, and we believe in Him, and we follow Him. And yes, He does take care of the wrongs, but He does it for our good. And ultimately, it's through His Son. That's why we're going to stand, we're going to sing. Burdens are lifted at Calvary. So many people are burdened today. I got an email from a dear friend, Christian, mind you, known for years, saying, I don't think anybody loves me. Christian now. I don't think anybody loves me. I said, well, you have a family. Your wife loves you. Your children love you. But I don't feel loved. I don't think anyone loves me. He said, I don't even think God can love me. How can a Christian say that? The only answer I have is that they have burdens that haven't been lifted yet. And they're forgetting who lifts those burdens and who has lifted those burdens. And that's our Lord and Savior Jesus. Amen? Think of that as we sing.